Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the After Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Yo, Leoden Day. How are you, sir?
Fantastic. I mean, I've got an extra special episode here, so I'm more than fantastic. We've got Justin Robert Young.
Oh, hi, friends. How are you?
And listen, guys, you've been doing a great job on After Things and Weird Things. And just for you know, we're recording After Things up front first because I've got news. Brian, Justin, you're fired.
Oh, doggone it. I knew this day was coming.
We have somebody, we have a special guest here that's probably after the show. Nobody's going to listen to us. They're just going to want to follow her. We're going to lose our audience. They're going to move on and keep following on. The wonderfully talented Ileana Douglas, who, if you check out her IMDb page, it goes on and on and on and on and on. Yeah. In a very short amount of time, I should point that out too. She has, you know, guys, once you hear her voice, you're going to remember who she is, recognize her immediately. She's got a book out right now called I Blame Dennis Hopper. You can go to her website, iblamedennishopper.com, and find out more about that. But Ileana, you're actress, would you call it, you're a comedian? I mean, you've done some great comedic roles.
Yes, actress, comedian, writer, director, producer, cook.
Amazing. So on After Things, you know, all around Ryan, Justin and I, you know, we're wannabes. Yes. We're people who are, you know, trying, going about stuff in sort of a small scale. You're a person who's working in a very, you're painting on a very large canvas here. And we want to talk a bit about that. And first up is, your book, I Blamed Dennis Hopper. I mean, the reviews on this are fantastic. Humorous and delightful, wholly entertaining.
Yeah, thank you. It's been amazing. People have to buy it before the paperback comes out, because that's always my fear, is that once the paperback comes out, then the hard copy goes way up, you know. So it's been getting great reviews. I'm going around the country touring, and tomorrow I'll be in Greenwich, Connecticut, then I'll be in Chicago. But you can find all of this. We have a Facebook page, I Blame Dennis Hopper, and you can find out all this by going there. See everywhere I am. That's very good. I am with a mic in my hand.
So you mentioned paperback is incoming, currently in hardcover. Is there an audiobook version by any chance?
There is an audiobook. Yes. I did the audiobook. I know there's a big audiobook. I love audiobooks, but so I recorded all the stories. And what's great about the book is that they're stories. So you can pick up, it's 15 stories. You can read any one of the stories. Some of my favorites are the story about Marlon Brando, but I talk about working on Goodfellas with Robert De Niro, Gus Van Sant, and To Die For. It's about how how movies have really told the story of my life, in beginning with Dennis Hopper, because my parents saw the movie Easy Rider in 1969, and they ended up being profoundly affected by it and became hippies.
Thank God it wasn't Kramer versus Kramer. It would have been very sad, different kill.
Ileana, this book is an interesting choice. You've seen a lot of people tour with acts like this where they're doing storytelling. Why did you want to have this be a book instead of performance art?
Well, it's funny you say that, because I'm doing a little bit of both. When I go out on the road and we have people, when I'm doing the book tour, I read from the book, or I'll have celebrities read from the book. We show clips. As I said, my whole life was kind of told through movies. My grandfather was Melvin Douglas, and now I work with Turner Classic Movies. So I'm kind of surrounded by movies. So I show clips of films in between reading selections from the book. So it goes a little bit back to my kind of stand-up roots too. But it is a little, actually, a bit of performing.
You're one of these people that you're perfect at the show, because you've done so many different things. You're a person that, between acting and directing and that. Was there a plan? Was there a, hey, you know, was 15-year-old Ileana sitting in her classroom going, or her commune saying, this is what I want to go do? Or how did all this happen?
Well, I was, you know, because my grandfather was Melvin Douglas, he really exposed me to movie making very early on by bringing me on the film set of being there. And that was sort of a game changer for me. I wanted to be in the movies in some capacity. I did not know what that would be, but I sort of fell into acting, literally, as I say in the book, just because I didn't have any money. We didn't have any money for me to go to college. So the options for when you don't have any money, it seems to be like starving and actor seem to really work well together. You don't have to have any skills really to be an actor. And since
you
I had such a screwed up childhood,
I live in Burbank, and I know a lot of children of legacies who don't have the success that you've had.
Oh, really?
It's
a combination. There. I mean, I always kind of joke around that I, you know, have fall. When you try really hard on things to get in movies, those are the parts I've lost. But it's usually just, sometimes when you're in the right place at the right time, as I write in the book, you know, because I had, as a joke, written that I had a blood-curdling scream on my resume. That's how I ended up meeting Martin Scorsese. So, you know, you never know. It's crazy sometimes how you meet people.
What were some of the roles that maybe you tried really, really hard for and just didn't happen for one reason or another?
Oh, my God. I mean, so many. I'm trying to think. There are a lot of the great, you know, a lot of the independent movies mainly that are starring Marissa Tomei. In the 90s, I just felt like I lost every part either to Marissa Tomei or Rosie O'Donnell.
Oh, jeez.
Heartbreak was the baseball movie.
League of Their Own?
Oh, League of Their Own. Killer. And I played softball, and that was a killer. I wanted to be in that movie so bad.
Were there any roles that you turned down that later on you're like, ooh, maybe that would have been a good one?
I never turn anything down. I answer the phone. I just say yes. I say hello. You know, I love to work, and I love to work, of course, with interesting people too. Sometimes you just do a movie because someone amazing is going to be in it. But I enjoy working. I enjoy all types of working. And the only time I've ever turned things down is when, sometimes there are certain things like I can't do. Like I can't, it almost sounds comic, but with the theme of your show, I cannot work with rats. That's something. I mean, people think it's funny,
guys.
But I remember turning down like horror movies or zombie movies because I was like, because there's rats in them, and there at one point you'd have to do something with the rats. And
is that the kind of thing that you have to have a conversation with your agent? Be like, hey man, let's just put this in black and white on everything that goes out.
People think you're kidding. You know, I'm like, I can't have a rat crawl over me. Like,
well, there goes our Willard remake. Thanks.
You know, so. There are certain horror movies or post-apocalyptic films that are going to be shot in water or mud or things like that, and those are the ones that I turn down. I've done movies in the snow. I don't want to work in the water. That's like another I've turned down things where you have to be on, you know, a boat or in the water. But anything with zombies I find – to be challenging because they're always shot at night. They're freezing cold. You're covered with mud and blood, and then you're going to have to be having things ripped off of you.
Let's talk about your first project with Martin Scorsese was what? New York Stories, right?
Technically it was The Last Temptation of Christ because that's when, as I say in the book, I was working for a film publicist named Peggy Siegel, and I got hired to dub screams in the movie The Last Temptation of Christ. And so that's how I met Martin Scorsese, and through that he had me audition for New York Stories.
And then that led to Goodfellas. So how, you know, people, you know, on the outside, you have one perception where it's like, yeah, you just show up to auditions and you do that and then you get selected. But part of it seems to be that, you know, people who get along well with others, and it's not just a matter of talent, but it's a matter of, you know, obviously you probably did a really good job in the dubbing suite with those screams that, you know, they decided to, you know, consider you for other stuff.
Actually, see that, I mean, most of the things that I've gotten, I'm very knowledgeable about films and movies, and I have good instincts. And I was always prepared to be able to act. And so, you know, when Martin Scorsese asked me to, he said, we're doing a loop group tonight at 5 o'clock. If you want to come back and do background voices. Now, I had no idea what that meant. But I said, absolutely, you bet, I'll be there. And, you know, when it was my turn to get a, you know, I understood filmically what he meant when he said background voices, which is the hubbub of crowds, because I'd seen a lot of these, you know, big spectacle movies from the 50s and 60s. So I kind of understood what he meant, and I got a handle on it. So he picked up right away that I was pretty good at and pretty knowledgeable, knowing what he wanted. And so he kept asking me to do more and more things. So he said, hey, can you, you know, we need to dub a line for Jesus's mother. Can you? It's a quote. This is a direct quote. We get a line, you know, Jesus's mother says, and the line was, you know, so they would bring it up. And the line was, you know, my son, my son. And I swear to God, it's like when he's carrying the cross and he's going through the streets and he's, and there's, you can see in the movie, and the mother comes up and she has to say, my son, as he goes by. And I did that.
Nice. And,
yeah. So I kept doing whatever he told me to do. I'd say, absolutely, you bet, I can do that.
That's pretty good advice, I think, when Martin Scorsese is the one doing the asking.
Yeah.
The answer is yes.
Right. Well, and then in between, because I knew so much about movies, we would, you know, I had my movie books out and things, and he's like, oh, you're reading about Joe Mankiewicz? You know, so so we would talk about movies, and I always assume, like, well, this is the only time in my life I'm going to meet Martin Scorsese. So, you know, I would ask him questions about none of his hit movies, of course, not like Raging Bull or Mean Streets. I would ask about After Hours and New York, New York, you know, all the quirky movies.
Well, you know, I think you brought up something very interesting of kind of bringing more preparation to something, yes, even if it is a small element of it, that you walked into a dubbing booth to scream for these looping sessions, but you also just knew more about the process and projected yourself as somebody that could be a valuable piece to a very complicated puzzle.
Yes. Yes. I always assumed in my delusional mind that I would be working in the movies. My idea of the movies, though, was like, I thought it was like the MGM studio system, though, you know what I mean, where you'd go to work. And I mean, the way I was discovered was actually exactly the way I thought it would happen. I thought that somebody would be like, you're amazing, I want to put you in movies. And that's kind of the way it happened, except on a smaller scale, of course.
Well, and it's funny because, like, I don't know if that's certainly the archetype, and a lot of people have that image. You know, that's very much not how things worked out for me. It was like nobody was ever going to come along, so I just, you know, made it up as I went along. But it sounds like in many ways that's exactly what you did as well. There was no structure. You didn't do the highfalutin Juilliard acting school and then, you know, go to the right audition and nail it and get the right, you know, small gigs and go up from there.
No, there was no money. And in fact, like I said, but for some reason I had a certain, and again, this goes back to the book and my roots. I think growing up in a very eccentric family, and very rebellious and, you know, kind of just doing what I wanted to do. And so I would go to these auditions and be like really out there and wear crazy outfits. And people didn't respond to me at all, but like, I didn't really care. I was convinced that somehow, some way I was going to make it. And I don't know why that is, but you have to have that inner belief in yourself.
Did you have a clear picture of what constituted making it? Like, did you have a clear definition of what success would feel like? And if so, at what age?
Well, after my grandfather took me on the set of Being There, and he started sending me movie books about classic Hollywood, and I started just reading more and more about films, and I wanted to be in films. That was really my goal, more so than theater, even though I started out doing musical theater as a kid. But what was a challenge for me was when I went to acting school, I was really kind of beat up a little bit because I'd come from theater. So I sort of thought I had it all going for me, but so the teachers didn't think so. So I got a lot of criticism when I was in school, but I thought it was great. I couldn't understand why. I didn't get the rave reviews that my classmates did. And then, again, getting this job in for film publicity, I just assumed it was a matter of time. Like, in my mind, we were working with directors like Norman Jewison and Brian De Palma. But I never thought, oh, they're going to discover me for being an actor. I thought like, hey, I'm in the movie business. We're working on the Untouchables here. It's only going to be a matter of time before I'm in the movies too. But this seemed like a good background. I know it's hard to explain maybe, but
sure. Well, oftentimes when you hear about successes like yours, where you encounter the right person and you do the right job, and you keep showing up and being available for any kind of job they need, the tendency is to look back and just think like, wow, man, it was a small world back then. Do you think it's significantly harder for people to break into the business nowadays?
Much harder, much, much harder. Because in my, I went to work in 1987, and I knew a lot about movies. And so I was given entree into this world because I was so knowledgeable about films and could, and everybody else in the office wanted to work with the movie stars. Like they wanted to work with Kevin Costner, which is ironic because I ended up doing a movie with Kevin Costner and I never ended up working with any of the directors that I was working with, even though I was great admirers of them. But I always wanted to work with a director. So if we were working on the Untouchables, I would say, oh, I want to, let me be an assistant to Brian De Palma, because it kind of made me feel as if I was in the film somehow and I was, helping the film. All those things helped me out later on when I was actually acting in a movie. I kind of understood the psychology of the director. But these days, I also had a great deal of patience so that when it was finally my turn, I was pretty skilled and pretty knowledgeable. These days, I don't know if we have kind of the training that we used to have, and like everybody has a camera and everybody is making movies. So how do you differentiate yourself? That's the problem.
How did you get people to see you? Because as an actress, when you're working with people in the business, very often people, see you as, oh, they're a neat person, all that, but they kind of, well, she does publicity, or they don't understand that you have your aspirations, your real skill set may be outside of there.
Right. Well, when it was, again, with me, it was just like a little bit haphazard. I'd been to acting school. I was trying to audition, but people weren't really responding to my auditions. I got much more of a response when I was working for Peggy Siegel, when I bypassed the casting process and was working with the directors. Then you know, but at the same time, I was also doing sketch comedy. I mean, I really thought that I was going to be doing comedy. Then my whole, but I shifted gears after I met Martin Scorsese, because that, you know, once I was in Cape Fear, everybody thought I was a dramatic actress. So I kind of went down that path. But, you know, you always have to do things that, you know, eventually I think you come back to what you are passionate about. And now I'm doing more writing and directing, and specifically doing comedic things, which is, I think, really my passion.
When did you discover that was your gift?
Well, I always thought it was my gift. Nobody else thought it was funny, but I thought it was pretty. I always thought when I was doing sketch comedy that I was very funny. But nobody laughed at my stuff. But then, you know, when I was hanging out with Martin Scorsese and doing my Raging Bullwinkle routines, he thought I was a riot. So he was like my first big, I think, real supporter. He would, you know, he'd come watch me do stand up, or I was doing like off Broadway plays. I remember like one night I was doing this play, you know, and somebody came backstage and said, you're not going to believe this, I think Martin Scorsese is sitting in the audience. But like, he thought I was great. So that was kind of good enough for me, you know.
Rocky and Bullwinkle.
Yes. Raging Bullwinkle.
So what was that?
Well, as you can imagine, it's a takeoff of Raging Bull, but with Rocky the Squirrel and Bullwinkle. And right. Luckily, no YouTube exists of it. But it was when I was doing stand-up for about a minute in 1987-88. It was one of my routines.
That's amazing.
Now you mentioned
Little Rocky trying to get Bullwinkle to hit him.
Yes.
You mentioned earlier that you kind of had these visions when you were going to break in as, you know, the big MGM old school Hollywood system, which is kind of ironic because you have such a name for independent movies, which also have changed dramatically over the past 15 years. What do you think is the biggest difference in independent, both movie making and distribution and everything?
Well, again, I was very lucky to, you know, I mean, for me, a movie like Easy Rider, 1969, really begins the, you know, independent film movement, and then goes into the 70s. And then when I started, you know, the 90s really was when Sundance kind of cracked open. And I did an independent film just because I really thought the script was amazing. It was called Grief. And I had followed up To Die For by doing this movie. It cost $28,000. My agents were horrified with this, you know, gay storyline. And people were thinking, like, what are you doing with your career? But I believed in the director and I believed in the story, and the movie went to Sundance, and that's totally changed my career. Because once I was up at Sundance, I met Allison Anders, and that's when I really, again, thought, you know, my roots really, you know, again, this rebellious upbringing, and independent films just seemed harsher and darker. The stories seemed more interesting, and those have been the kind of movies that, you know, that I've been most passionate about being in, you know, less interference, more character driven, and primarily great stories for women.
So you've had a lot of conversation around the fact that those movies are even harder to make and harder to distribute now than they were in the 90s, which is widely considered to be just a huge boom time for a film like that. Do you think that that's true or?
So true. I'll do like five movies in a year. And then, I have friends who remind me that we were in a movie together. We go, whatever happened to that movie? I'm like, we were? They're like, yes, we've been in three films together. I'm like, where, what happened to them? So, you know, you go do these movies and I don't know what happens to them. Sometimes they appear on, you know, VOD or sometimes, you know, you'll see a DVD of it, but
I guess that's one of the weird things is people imagine that you work on a movie and that becomes your life, and then when it comes out, you're like, oh, it's my baby. I've been there from the beginning. But that is not, as I understand it, how it is for actors. It's a gig. You're doing it, and you do your job. You do the best you can. You do what the director tells you, and then after that, it's their baby, and maybe you encounter it again down the road, and you're like, oh, hey, that one turned out to be good. Or you're like, oh, hey, that turned out to be not so good.
I know. Again, and that's the saddest thing, and I had something, again, that I write about, is that there was a period, a glorious period in the mid-90s, where you'd go do a film, you know, like To Die For, that wasn't a big budget film. I mean, I think it was, you know, maybe 8 million something in that arena. And you'd have 3 weeks of rehearsal, get to know all the actors, you'd make the movie, then it would go to the Toronto Film Festival. It was just a longer period. You'd go to all the film festivals. It would come out. You'd go to promote it in Europe. I mean, I remember, you know, being flown to Europe after the American release to go do all the foreign release. Well, now there's just absolutely no money to do all of that. So, I mean, you're lucky if you do a movie in 20 days and then it comes out, you maybe do one day of press on it. And it's not as it's kind of, some of the enjoyment has been taken away in that sense, and the most fun part of it now is if the movie gets in a festival like Sundance, because Sundance is still a very important film festival.
It's interesting you talked about this when you first did it. It was Grief. Is that 92, 93, 94, that period at Sundance, it's when we saw Reservoir Dogs, and we saw so many, I think, so many things that shaped film for the next 20 years, and so many of the people who are now big talents today starting at that point.
I agree. I saw that. I think I saw that year Kevin Smith's Clerks.
Mm.
I mean, it was a thing. Independent film was exploding, and you wanted to be a part of it. I mean, everybody wanted to be a part of independent film. And, you know, we were developing films. I did, you know, I mean, I was just doing independent film after independent film. And we were all, you know, seeing each other and friends and making movies together. And then, you know, around, I always think it was like around 2003, things started fragmenting and not becoming, you couldn't put together a movie anymore.
So have you been able to watch kind of the changing face nowadays? We see a lot of young people who not only act, but want to do their own cinematography. And of course you have equipment that's gotten so much cheaper. Distribution is cheaper. Yeah. You have these YouTube movie makers or whatever. Do you know any of the folks in that scene, or is that a case, like, how do you view that changing shape? If somebody wants to get into acting and get into the Hollywood scene now, in your experience, what's the best angle for them to take?
I watch them. I watch a lot of the YouTube things where I did a web series called Easy to Assemble. And what I was wrong about I knew that web series were going to be the new independent film. I knew that. So I called that one correctly. And I kind of got out of independent film and started doing web series.
That was for IKEA, right?
Yeah, what I was wrong about was in cultivating a YouTube channel. Mm. And the people that cultivated their YouTube channels back then were very, very smart. Because in a sense, you know, they're curating their life, and they're their own distribution platform, and they've had all these years to get, you know, their own fan base. And so that is really important. But that's one type of filmmaking. That's like that very simple, it's almost like autobiographical storytelling, right? Where they're talking to the camera.
Sure.
And being kind of funny on camera. That doesn't require any cinematography. And in a sense, this is what I find challenging as an artist. That's just as valid, if not more valid, than something that looks beautiful and, you know,
man,
has some art to it. I find that a little frustrating, because I still like to look at pretty pictures and and really be moved by something sitting in a cinema with other people.
I love the fact that you recognize that artistically it has its own merits for its own rewards, because there are a number of people who, you know, and there's less of it now as the legitimacy of YouTube continues to rise. But there's certainly people who would be like, ah, these kids and their webcams, just turn it on and, you know, take a picture of a cat pooping and all of a sudden they got a million views. Boo.
Yeah, absolutely. That was one of the things I was totally wrong about that. When we were doing Easy to Assemble, I had friends that were doing YouTube stuff and they used to make fun of me because I would put all the money into the show, making it look good and cinematic and making it look like a movie.
But there's still.
And in the end, it didn't really matter. I would have been better off concentrating more on social media. And I had some people doing that, like really building their Twitter following. And I was a little behind the game in that. Now I realize how important it is. I mean, in terms of selling my book, social media has, and Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, it's been incredible how important it is.
You know, I think there's a middle ground, though. You know, Brian's got his YouTube golden play button for a million subscribers, and his stuff is really well produced. Brian's Scam School is, you know, it's TV level product. Well, cable TV production level.
All right. Hold on. One of the editors is right here in the room now.
Hey, come on. Like I said, cable TV level production skills. Above Fuse, way above Fuse.
Okay, good.
You're right that, you know, you see a lot of these people who've built up these followings just by talking straight to camera, but in some ways it's talk radio for tweens. There's a limit to what they can do. You know, you went off, you had a sponsor, you hit IKEA, you were able to figure out how to integrate into a product, and maybe you're ahead of the curve, but I think that as we're seeing increased production values as sponsors have stepped on to, you know, in the game, I don't think your instincts are wrong at all on that.
Yeah, the other thing I was wrong about with the brands is that there were no brands after IKEA that, you know, when we started working with IKEA, everything was like, you know, hold the gum. Like I did a web series with Trident, and all it was like, no, hold the gum, eat the gum. They didn't even care about the story as long as every celebrity just had to
whenever the gum's not on camera, everyone should be saying, where's the gum?
Exactly.
Where's the Trident gum?
They were promoting some, you know, fruit-flavored gum, and it was like, okay, that's all they cared about. IKEA, it was the opposite. They didn't want to have any, you know, it was like the store was a character in the show. So
lifestyle,
we didn't
brand
have to advertise. But no other sponsor post IKEA has loosened the reins in the way that IKEA did. It's still, you know, like when you see some of these shows, podcasts, like, you know, Adam Carolla is a good example. He does the show and he's very entertaining, and then he stops for a commercial, and that's the way they did it in the 1950s.
Sure.
Where they hold the product and they plug the product and then they go back to the entertainment. So it still feels like that feels very, very traditional.
I think, you know, the changing, you know, Brian and Justin, you know, I watched these two knuckleheads out water skiing for a car company.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny. I like the fact that you bring it back to the 1950s, because it would be in the middle of the Andy Griffith Show that all of a sudden you weren't sure if it was still the show or not, but they're talking about Grape Nut cereal. That's almost where the content evolves into, you know, because it's so personality driven, and marketers, people doing these big ad buys, they don't just want you to pause everything and play some pre-produced commercial. They want to feel like this is part of the experience. They want your personality to come through, which is interesting, because the people who are saying yes to these gigs are being grilled a lot harder on, like, no, seriously, do you actually like Toyota vehicles? Because we don't want you to do this if you don't like Toyotas, because that's just going to be weird.
Just for background, Brian and Justin did a VR campaign for a Toyota RAV4 where they followed them around with their shenanigans doing various adventures in VR. So you could watch them in VR, and it was a RAV4 taking them from place to place.
Well, I mean, no, Andrew, it was the all-new RAV4 hybrid, of course. just an amazing machine and so economical. But it was funny because we had the ad people on set, and they were
very, very careful to tell us, like, don't ham this up. Like, they didn't want us to be, it was more like the IKEA experience for you, Ileana, where they were like, just like barely, if you need to mention this thing, then do it. But don't, you know, turn to the camera and wink and say, oh, what a value. You know, like they wanted it to be a little softer.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. It's almost like, again, TV is still a little clunky versus the web stuff, which has been this. I predicted that right. What, to me, web stuff and YouTube is basically all is where all the independent filmmakers have gone. I mean, I'm very curious. You guys saw, you know, Woody Allen's doing a web series.
Netflix,
now.
Yeah,
it's crazy.
Yeah. Well, let me talk to you about TV, because one of the role that for me I adored that you did was action, and that in the early 2000s, and that in watching it again for when it came out was kind of way ahead of its time for where TV was going to go. Not only in some of the languages and the subject matter, but, you know, even for, you know, only a few years later, Entourage comes out, and that makes actions kind of in Hollywood jokes look soft by comparison.
I know.
But is that something that you would agree with?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, there's a chapter in the book called The Roulette Wheel of Insanity, and I describe how sometimes you do a movie and it's completely insane and nobody gets along and everybody's fighting and it's a huge hit. And then sometimes you do a show like Action where it's like love, everybody's crazy about each other. And it's, and you know, we were on the cover of TV Guide and everybody thinks it's amazing. And you got canceled after 13 episodes. So, you know, it's like you just never know.
I would imagine that at some level, I don't want to say that you just develop a thick skin. I guess, yeah, sure, you get a thick skin. You become just a little bit emotionally divorced from the outcome. You understand that something can be really, really good and really visionary and you know, not do well now. And then you have phenomenon like, you know, we'll say Firefly, where, you know, years after it's canceled, this uprising of it's the best thing ever pops up.
Yeah, that was, well, of all the things I've done, Action to me is the most surprising, because
that was the Jay Moore series.
Yeah. Just because I mean, we had Ted Demme was our director, you know, Chris Thompson, the writer, Jay Moore, Buddy Hackett, the quality of the writing was so good and it was so dark. And the popularity of the show, you know, we had Sandra Bullock was on it, and Keanu Reeves and Selma Hayek, Ice Cube. I mean, people were dying to be on the show. And I thought that the story of it was, you know, was really dark. And people really loved it.
Do you think that it had trouble because it was on a broadcast network? Whereas if it was on HBO or something, it would have been a different situation.
Well, it was developed for HBO, right?
Yeah, that's people always say that. That's, you know, that may be the case. Had we stayed with HBO, you know, and not been on Fox, because once we went to Fox, I believe we were the first show that had bleeping. They had to bleep us.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, it was a freewheeling show. And I think maybe the timing of, I don't know, a lot of people came out against the show, too. You know, they were saying that it was crass and vulgar and ruining family values.
Oh, dude, yeah.
This is, you know, a show where Jay Moore plays a character that, you know, lines of which would be almost indistinguishable from Ari Gold, which, you know, came out, what, 4 years later and was the most beloved, you know, character on television for a decade. It was so good. And it's so funny that, I mean, you mentioned 13 episodes. Today, that would be like, oh, look, a successful first season for Action. I'm really looking forward to the next one.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, they canceled us for supposedly having low ratings, and our ratings were like, you know, 4.4 4.5 to 5, which now...
Which nowadays is astonishing, right? It's like a presidential address.
Right. I think 2 is considered like good now. Imagine the thing people got like a 12 share or something.
Well, and we've talked about this before. It's fascinating. You know, there was a time in the mid 80s when and this is the example of a podcaster friend of mine, Dan Carlin. He points out that in the mid 80s on a Wednesday night, a middling episode of The Golden Girls would get like a 10-point, you know, 10 million yeah. views or whatever. And nowadays, you know, you have someone like, you know, Bill O'Reilly is crowing about having a 250,000 viewers every night or something.
Yeah,
he does a lot more than that.
I know, but it might as well be. It's amazing.
Yeah. Well, I think, again, it was, you know, the stunt casting of Buddy Hackett was way ahead of its time. You know, just celebrities being, like you say, Entourage kind of did the, you know, covered that same territory. But you know, we were one of the first.
But also there's something to be said about where the HBO audience then and now is very different than people who would identify as, you know, a Fox audience. You know, if you're on HBO, it's because you like movies and you're going to get, when Jay Moore makes a John Woo reference about pigeons, you know, you're going to get that because you know that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's one of the things that's helped now and why we're having this golden age of TV is that because there are so many different more outlets for it, you can take more sophisticated fare and put it somewhere else where you're not going to have executives going, nah, the joke's not landing. Make it dumber. You know, make it that you're going to you have a little more room.
Well, in fact, now what ends up happening is which is kind of strange, is the note is to make it darker or more, put more drugs in it or make it more sexual. And it's like, I don't know how much more sexual you can get. You know, my mom watches Game of Thrones, and I come in and I'm like, fuck, there's all this nudity freaking me out. Like, why is my mother watching this stuff?
I've been watching Vinyl by your friend, and it's really good, but it's also got like this, there's like some Final Cut Pro or Avid preset that HBO uses, like, okay, put in a wanker here, put in this here, drug use here, da 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 da. Which, again, if you're doing a, you know, a series about the music industry of the 1970s, that's a given. But it is, there is a formula now that it's just this, you know, it's going to hit these beats for that.
Sure. No, if there's more than 3 lines of exposition, you have to have some kind of graphic nudity or drug use or something.
You guys are younger than me. Like, how do you feel about that? I mean, I find it disturbing, but maybe because I'm old fat. I mean, I feel like, is that giving us a, I don't know, just like there's no barriers. Like how do you guys feel about that?
I think part of it is, you know, where it is used. I think with Game of Thrones is such, so much of its own just kind of explosion of all these sort of elements that I don't really mind it there, but it's been interesting to see that it's not necessarily just a thing where you can throw it in and it does well, because you've seen so many other shows that, you know, both on pay cable and on basic cable that have tried to replicate either the violence or the sex of Game of Thrones that hasn't necessarily been able to draw the same eyeballs. So I think it's good to have it as a tool, you know, but to say that it's overused, I think would not be a stretch.
Right, because then where do you go? Like, where do you, there's nowhere else to go, you know?
These things have a tendency to, and again, nudity on cable late night is not a new thing. That's been around forever. And, you know, one of the reasons that people watched it, I think there's a tendency for things to kind of go out there, then go back. If we go back and we look at some of the films in the early 70s, you know, you would find that, you know, they were kind of pushing limits. You know, before the whole, was it the Film Standards Code, you know, back in the 1920s, you know, things were, you know, much more, you know, risque, you know, and even, you know, you go back and you look at King Kong and, you know, when he takes the dress off of the character in 1933, that would not have happened 3 years later. And so I think these things go more, back and forth.
What I find is that's more titillating, though. You know what I mean? It's, if you see it, like there was a movie, I remember when I was a kid and my mom took me to see, because, you know, it was Diane Keaton, but we went to see Looking for Mr. Goodbar, and there's like a lot of nudity in it. And she's walking around naked. But it was part of the story versus now sometimes when I see a film And the sex scenes are almost shot like action scenes. You know, the guy throws the girl up against the wall. I'm like, it's a little, for me, a little off-putting.
There's always been a history of certain genres of film that have done that. And, you know, and then you get, you know, Halle Berry famously in Swordfish. They're like, what check do we need to write to get you to go topless?
Right.
You know, it's silly. There's nothing for the plot, but they knew for like, well, you know, we're going to increase the number of young males that will come in and see our movie if they know this is there. And I think with HBO, part of their audience is that it certainly is done for titillation's sake. And there certainly is limit points where you go like, all right, we didn't really need that. That was absolutely, you know.
Well, and I think oftentimes that the ones where those scenes make sense in the context or actually do advance the plot in some way are the ones that do well over time. You know, it's like you go back and watch any of the schlock horror from the late 70s, and it's real clear when all of a sudden somebody has a budget just to, you know, throw a few extra buckets of blood because they can or so on. Right. Whereas you've got, you know, wonderful movies like The Exorcist, where it's judicious use of those things and all of it relevant to the main story.
I have a real quick aside. So when I was living in Florida, I had a friend that was an aspiring filmmaker, and he wanted to use my parents' house, and then there's a boat on the dock there, and he wanted to know if he could go shoot there. And I'm like, yeah, sure, you can go ahead. So they came in for a day. The crew was really nice. It was just really small crew. They shoot some stuff, whatever. And then later on, like a year later, he shows me a cut of the film, and I watch his detective, the character playing the detective, walk into the house, go search the boat, then like walk back into the house, open up a door, and it was a cut shot to some completely different room where there's some girl topless reading a magazine who just looks over at him, smiles, and he's like, mm-hmm, shuts. It was like, and it was purely because when he was trying to sell it on the home video market, you know, some guy's like, we got to have some TNA. So they just literally cut it. And it's, I remember the old adage, like, always have your character at some point get footage of them on the phone. You don't have to do dialogue. Just have them talking on the phone. So later on, you can put that back in and add whatever exposition you need. And apparently in this genre, it was like, always have your character open up a door because you can have a naked broad in there. And it'll save the film.
That's amazing.
You know, it is something interesting, though, because you've seen also on shows like, you know, Girls on HBO, where you have a lot of nudity, but very rarely is it necessarily titillating, right? Like it is there to project something else, although certainly something that is meant to heighten a scene that would otherwise, you know, be something different if Lena Dunham's top were still on.
Right. No. Well, that's what I always wonder, from a writer's point of view, like, does then writing something that doesn't have nudity in it become, or drugs, or, you know, what if you don't have the drug experience? Are you supposed to put that in because everybody else is doing it?
Well, isn't that the kind of game where, I think I'm literally thinking of video game simulators where it's like this Roller Coaster Tycoon. There was some movie making tycoon thing where you had to say like, all right, you would get newspapers that says everyone's scared of drugs. So you're like, all right, let's put more drugs in our movie. It'll do better. I mean, I would imagine, I don't want to reduce the entire cinema, you know, the movie making experience down to it, but from the production standpoint, I would imagine that whatever it is you feel like everybody's, you know, worried about, terrified of, excited about, just figure a way to wedge it in there.
I guess. I mean, that's, you know, I haven't faced that issue yet. I mean, as you guys were saying, when we did Action, it was we had pushback in the other way, in the other area, you know, where we had to clean up the story or not be able to say certain things, certain storylines we couldn't do. We couldn't be too suggestive. Now it's almost the opposite way. Like as when you're watching television, CBS, any of the big channels, I'm shocked at like some of the stuff.
Well, and it's funny, like, but we do, and I have very, very limited, you know, we did a TV show called Hacking the System on National Geographic, and we got from Standards and Practices the reverse, where they're all like, yeah, don't mention this brand name. Yes, it is factually true that you could combine these two objects to cause this to happen. Let's gloss over that. We don't want these guys to be upset that we're talking about how to use their product and so on. So it's like, just as you see, I don't know, it's weird to essentially feel this pressure to not share the factual things. I don't know. It's crazy.
I told you when recording the opening introduction for my show, the note was my line was like, I mean, or mean I like to mess with people. And the note was, no, we want them to say, I want to F word
with people.
And I'm like, and I'm dubbing this. I'm like, they're not going to use that. I'm like, yeah, I know, we'll cut it out, but they'll bleep it over, whatever. I'm like, no, I promise you, there's an executive in there that thinks this is going to be edgy and all this. But what's going to happen is we're going to turn in this copy, and you're going to call me back in here to say, I like to mess with people. So can we just record those lines? You know, and of course. Yeah. I like to mess with people, you know, but it was just because somebody, you know, was like, we need to do this edgy. I had a meeting with a children's network that at some point I need to write down the graphic language in which they described, you know, you need to F with them. We need to do this. We need to do this. I'm like, oh my God,
you're talking about children. What's going on?
That's horrible.
I mean,
are you going to buy the show?
the stories from that production are just.
Yeah. Well, I guess, I mean, again, I have no kind in my day, you know, we'd see nudity in a drive-in movie. That was like, as you were talking about horror movies and stuff, that's when you'd always see nudity. But, you know, you didn't tell your parents or anything.
Well, and plus, like, there was some, I want
to
say.
Dad took you to the movie like mine did.
I started watching the beginning of what in the U.S. was released as Dungeon Master. It was released as Rage War in the rest of the country. This is a PG-rated film that shows full frontal female nudity in a nightmare scene where she's being drug off instantly. And I think part of it is that we just didn't have the fidelity of filtering that we have now. We have more rankings, you know, there's, you know, on YouTube, there's community standards and guidelines and so on. I think there was just one fire hose that everybody shoved everything through back in the day.
We do want to remind everybody that Ileana's book, I Blame Dennis Hopper and Other Stories from a Life Lived in and Out of Movies, available now. Go to Amazon and pick it up. And by the way, on Goodreads, 199 ratings and a 4-star review. The people have spoken, Ileana, and they love this book.
Yeah, no, it's been great. I've gotten so many wonderful responses from people just about the book, whether it's, you know, again, talking about some of my work experiences with, you know, with Martin Scorsese and Robert De Niro, to just movie going experiences, what it was like to see Jaws for the first time. And it's a memoir that's told through the movies, celebrating all the, you know, so many movies that I saw as a kid, you know, starting in the 70s.
Well, by the way, just within 5 minutes of you getting on Skype with us, I was able to find it and buy it on Audible. I cannot wait to dive in. All of it is read by you on the Audible presentation?
All of it. Yeah. In fact, it was a couple times. It's interesting because you have to read sad, you know, parts. And we had to stop a couple times because I made myself cry reading my own sad material.
You know, I've heard that, especially for autobiographical stuff, that you have a little bit more leeway with audiobooks, that a lot of, especially comedians that are reading their own books, will kind of just sort of freestyle a little bit, since it is a very conversational storytelling thing. Is that something that you did with the audiobook?
No, I did it because the stories, again, the way the book is set up is that it's 15 stories. So each story has a very, you know, set up beginning, middle, and end. You know, so if I'm talking about, you know, how it came to be that I met Marlon Brando, or how, working on great, you know, this movie I did, Grace of My Heart. What I tried to do is tell one amazing story with a beginning, a middle, and an end. So it really had to be told exactly the way I've been telling it. A lot of these stories are stories that I've told people over the years, and they kept saying, please, you got to write a book for people that love movies. You've worked with all these amazing people. And I like to think of myself as a rememberer. I've got a great memory, and I feel like it's becoming, you know, we're almost forgetting. We can watch movies on Netflix, but we don't have a context to people who've actually, you know, met Marlon Brando and can actually talk about what he was like.
Well, I want to put your memory to the test real quick. We just got a tweet from our friend Brett Rounceville on Twitter, who interrupts us saying, "Psst, she played the manager of Aerosmith on the pre-show for Disney's Rock and Roller Coaster. Is that for reals?"
Yeah, that was really a lot of fun. Just a strange. I was doing the Drew Carey show, which was a Disney show. But I just got this call like, "Hey, do you want to go to Florida and be Aerosmith's manager in the Rock and Roller Coaster?" And I was a big Aerosmith fan when I was a kid. So that was an absolute blast. We shot this little thing. Ken Marino, actor, very popular, is also he had a very small part in our little pre-movie, but that will play forever.
That is awesome.
No. In fact, it's playing right now. They're in the Hollywood Studios now in Orlando.
Yeah, I only had to ride the ride once when they opened it, and I was so sick. First of all, I don't like roller coasters, but this is a roller coaster in the dark.
Oh, it's fantastic. It's probably one of my favorite rides in all of Disney, for sure.
Is it?
Oh, yeah. No, yeah, definitely. I mean, the mixture of the soundtrack and the context and being just the right amount of wacky, loved it.
Yeah. Well, that's good.
There's all sorts of media. There's theatrical, there's film, there's television, and amusement park. And that's the thing you think about is how many times a day people are in that line queue and they see you.
Oh, I'm sure more people have seen that than anything I've ever done, you know. Well, everywhere I go, people say, "Make it a super stretch," or, you know.
So let me ask you this. What is that the role that people recognize you for the most, or you get quoted about the most?
I don't know. Usually people come up to me and there's a certain group of people that love Grace of My Heart. Of course, Goodfellas is, you know, people love Goodfellas. People love Cape Fear. They always want to, you know about Robert De Niro. But there's some of the quirky films I've been in, like Happy Texas. People love Stir of Echoes, Action.
Oh, Stir of Echoes.
Some of the television work I've done, like the Larry Sanders Show or 6 Feet Under. So usually people have their own favorite. I've got a pretty wide fan base. Ghost World is another one. People love Ghost World. I've been going around the country with that. And then I also have my whole other fans from Turner Classic Movies. And they're amazing. They're on Twitter, TCM Party. And we watch movies on TCM, and we tweeted each other during the movie, and that's really fun.
Isn't that we've talked about social media earlier, but social media in many ways has kind of shaped or reshaped what it means to be a performer, because it used to be that acting was about, you know, your role, your performance at one time. Maybe you would do some appearances on some late night television shows or whatever. But in so many ways, the act never stops. You know, there's a element to it where you have to tell the truth and give your part. I mean, even now, as we're doing this hour long podcast where we talk about the experience and the craft of the art. I personally think it's wonderful that it just offers this increased fidelity between you and the fans.
I do too. You know, it's always a challenge because I feel what's interesting is that some people can pull it off and some people have no interest in doing Twitter. And I respect that. You know, they don't know how to do it. They don't want to do it. They don't want to engage with the fans.
Yeah.
I love engaging with the fans because I love movies. And so for me, the internet was such a great way to talk to other people about movies. You know, what did you think of this film? You know, did you like it? Did you not like it? Or again, to share interesting films with people. And so I love communicating with the fans. You know, we're all watching TCM. We're making, you know, our little jokes together. You know, we have our little film community. But then again, you can educate people, and I've been educated about films, you know, too, that certain films that I don't know, and people suggest movies, etc.
Well, that's a perfect segue right now into the part of our show where we make picks. And we recommend things for people out there to check out. Obviously, our pick is going to be I Blame Dennis Hopper by, what's the name of the author? I think Ileana Douglas.
Yes.
I heard it's really good.
My pick is specifically the audiobook version.
No, hardcover. Okay. My
make
pick
sure
is
to give me, if you like it too, make sure to go give me a good review up on Amazon.
Oh, we have talked.
Things, again, talking about social media, you know, the artist has a really, it's interesting these days, as you guys know, it's harder because you have to do a lot, but it's also, you know, you have this ability with fans and your fan base to support each other. And those kind of things really work to people that are looking at numbers. And so, you know, you may not have, I'm going to be brutally honest, you may not get the money that you used to get in my day, but you'll have the ability to keep working. And in a sense, that's the most important thing.
Man, you could not have a more enthusiastic group of people supporting that sentiment, because you're looking at a guy with the number one, down below me, Justin has the number one highest reviewed card game on Amazon that's not called Cards Against Humanity. You have Station Breaker. Andrew's book just came out, obviously blowing it up on the reviews on Amazon. I'm sure at some point I'll do something that I need reviews on. But it's like, man, it really, really matters.
It really does. And like that when I'm going around the country doing the book tour, that's what I always tell people is like, if you like the book, you know, please go to Amazon, review it, go to the Facebook page, give me a like, because these things, you know, are all the publishers, you know, they look at these things and they matter.
Yeah.
And it gives you the ability to just keep working.
And it's one of those things where, like, there's a big difference between 87 positive reviews and 107 positive reviews. And it's like, you, every little bit helps.
It does. It's true. It really is true. And I try to do that for other people too. You know, I go to their, it's, you know, just set aside 20 minutes every day to help all your friends do their social media, and then you're done. It's like taking a vitamin.
I just bought a hardcover book, and based upon your conversation about that, I just put up a 5-star review.
Everybody follows suit.
Thank you.
They're pretty used to me begging and pleading, bargaining.
Well, it's one of those really touching things when it actually works. It does matter. It's not, what people have to understand is it's not for your ego.
No.
You appreciate it, but it's really like, you know, people, I learned this working for IKEA. You know, when we were getting millions of people to watch Easy to Assemble, you know, that's what was getting the money for us to do a second season.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. All those impressions and all those things really, really matter to people, the powers that be, that will keep letting you continue, you know, your growth.
To our listeners out there, another thing you can do is if you go on the Amazon page right now and you're logged in, click follow on her, below her name, for the author account. And what that will do is the number of people that follow whenever she puts out a new book or it's a new format or whatever, they will send emails out to people who are following it. So be sure to follow her on there too. It's not, doesn't get as much attention as other things. Obviously, if you can get the book, buy the book, you know.
Yes. And
I have also bought the hardcover on Amazon, and I am going to rate it 5 stars.
Awesome. You guys are great. That. Any movie questions?
I feel like I want to give a review that says highly interactive. It's like we were having a conversation.
That is what everybody says about the book. I tried to make it seem like as if you were sitting next to me on the couch and you're watching, you know, Cape Fear with me or some of the movies that I've been in, because I'm just as much of a movie fan, you know, as I am an actor and all of that. I'm a fan of these people, you know, as well as acting in the scenes with them.
Absolutely.
I think that's what my review said, is that you have a great perspective as both a fan and a Hollywood insider. So,
oh my God, totally. Like I could barely work with Robert Mitchum. I was like, I just kept asking him. Usually that's what happens, is like the first day they're really flattered And then by day three, like Buck Henry in who wrote The Graduate on To Die For, he said, Eliana, you can sit here, but you can't ask me any questions about The Graduate. Like, please, I've answered everything.
Get smart too, right?
Oh, I mean, like, I try to do it in a way that I'm like, they're here. I got to, you know, I want to be a rememberer. I want to, you know, I want to find out the real story.
Was there a moment, is that the best moment of you just fangirling, geeking out next to somebody and them just being like, all right, come on, we're actually here to work?
No, well, the craziest of all was, you know, was again meeting Marlon Brando, and I just burst out crying. I was like one of those girls that saw the Beatles, you know. I just, I mean, I had a poster of him in my, you know, bedroom wall, and my acting teacher always talked about him being the greatest actor of all time. And then, you know, meeting Marlon Brando, I just, looking in Marlon Brando's eyes, I just, it's like, I just burst out crying. And it ended up, but I was glad that I did it, because then I made him cry. And then it ended up turning into an amazing day into night. So sometimes, like, you just, you know, I fangirl, you know, I'm a geek all the time. I geek out all the time.
That's awesome.
Do you have a pick or recommendation, anything you've seen lately or read lately, or anything you want to tell people about?
God, I would say, I mean, of course, I've seen all the movies for this year. I think some of the documentaries have been incredible. Like Amy, I thought the documentary on Amy Winehouse was great. Listen to Me, Marlon was great. There's I watch all the Michael Moore documentaries. But I thought Amy was really, I've seen it about three times.
Wow.
I think the documentaries, that's a very interesting one. And also, you know, the movie from last year, Citizen Four.
What we're getting
now with documentaries is that they're almost telling them like narrative films. And that's a really interesting way to go if you don't feel that you can write a whole narrative film, is to combine documentary, but use the, you know, make it like a plot. Because the plot of Amy, whether or not her life was really that way, they created a plot for that documentary.
Excellent. Well, this is the time where we're going to bring this to a close, and we're going to start up Weird Things very soon. So for our After Things listeners, thank you, everybody, for tuning in. And your homework is check out I Blame Dennis Hopper. If we want to have more nice guests like Eliana, then we need to put on a good show. Show what our support can mean.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for stopping in, Eliana.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. It's been a pleasure. And good luck to you guys.
Thank you. It's been After.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.